Welcome. Bienvenidos a Tertulias con Omar Negroni. What's a tertulia? A gathering, a hangout. That's what we do. Un compartir con amigos. We talk to amazing musicians, artists, and people involved in the arts in general. Dale, anímate. Te invitamos to listen to us on your favorite platform, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcast. Estamos gozando. Yeah. Thank you, guys. We're back. All right, Johnny's here. So, guys, like I was saying, this is very special podcast. We're going to have the amazing, the incredible Mr. John Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Oh, my God. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Super excited to be here with you tonight, John.
Oh, my God. Sorry about the technological foul play there.
John, what a pleasure. I mean, thank you for accepting our invitation. I mean, it's an honor. I mean, we're all super fans and, you know, your history and you keep doing it. And it's just an amazing experience for us right now.
Great. Thank you so much, Omar. And it's, you know, all of us in these, man, these times are just, there's so much creativity, though, coming out of this bullshit that, but it's really great. And I'm honored to be here and, you know, and to finally see you in person and, you know, and you know, get to know a lot more Instagram people. And it's, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm blessed.
No, thank you. Thank you, John. All right, John. I mean, everybody knows, I mean, everybody knows your story. Everybody knows all the records, all the amazing things you have done and keep doing it. But I always try to go from a couple, from the beginning, just for a few people.
You mean when I was an embryo?
where were you born?
I was born in Southwest Iowa in a town called Creston, Iowa. And the town was about 8,000 people, and it was the highest points between the Mississippi and the Missouri River.
Were you the first musician in the family or not?
No. My dad was an optometrist, and he played violin and great piano. And sang in a choir and sang in a barbershop quartet and arranged. And then my mother was basically the ears. She was like really into big bands and stuff. So God bless my late sister. She tried to play clarinet, but, you know, I think she was put in the front row for her short skirt. God bless you, Judy.
Hey, John. So in your house, you were listening to it from jazz to classical, everything. When do you decide, I want to play drums?
I apparently, as a little boy, I'm sure we all are. We were all, you know, pounding on the table, and our mothers probably yelled at us and stuff. But I started playing piano when I was 5, and then I switched over to drums between 7 and 8. It was a natural progression. And, you know, my piano faltered a bit. But, you know, the drums took off, and I still, you know, play piano to this day. But, you know, between 7 and 8.
Nice. So, John, do you start taking private lessons or just listening to records and messing up with the drums? How did it start?
When I was a little kid, it was just records, you know, and my mom would play me records and tell me, you know, this is Gene Krupa, you know, this is Buddy Rich, this is so-and-so, listen to the Count Basie band. Listen to how stuff swings. And, you know, in Southwest Iowa, there weren't a lot of teachers. So we were like, the nearest teacher was like way up northern Iowa, and it was just too far away. So I started, you know, studying legitly with a guy named Lionel Foley, who had gone to my church. And he was, ironically, a percussion major in Chicago. And then moved to our town and like became the high school principal and stuff. But he started me on snare drum rudiments, but I was already playing in a band before that. So, you know, nobody really taught me drum set.
Right. So you're doing both worlds at the same time. You're doing your training, but at the same time you're playing with your friends.
Yes. I mean, you know, and thus back up for friends, because I started playing, you know, between 7 and 8. And it's not like you can go next door and go, you know, hey, Bobby, you know, bring your bass over. You know, there's not a lot of 8-year-old bass players. Except now on Facebook and Instagram, there's like 2 amazing kids that are just killing me here. But I said to my mom when I was like, I turned 10, I go, man, I got to play with somebody. So we found a 9-year-old guitar player named Kevin Clemens. And ironically, I just got some pictures sent to me from one of our performances when we were little kids. So I'll probably post that. But he was a really good guitar player, and we started forming a band at a young age. So then I finally had somebody to play with.
Mostly rock and roll, pop rock, mostly, or jazz?
Yeah, remember, this was early 60s. So, you know, we were still, you know, the Beatles hadn't hit yet. And, you know, I was playing like Venture stuff and maybe, you know, when the Beatles did hit, we were playing a couple of simple songs and, you know, playing Pipeline and, you know, like more like surf music and then maybe starting to get into some, you know, rock and roll and R&B.
Right. Okay. So John, okay. You're doing all that during high school. You're doing a lot of music in high school. You're like in a jazz band in high school, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I had a huge career, like even, you know, from junior high. My high school, junior high jazz band, it was the first album I ever recorded. It was in 1969, and we won the Mid-America Jazz Festival. So then, you know, going from there, I started going to summer camps at Northwest Missouri State and Illinois State. And I also was a basketball player, so I had gone to Iowa State University for basketball camp. But, you know, I was so busy playing drums that, you know, basketball always took a second seat to me. So, yeah, in high school, I started playing with the band directors. But at the same time, I had a couple of great rock bands.
Nice. Okay, so you graduate high school. I mean, you get the scholarship because of basketball. That's pretty...
Yeah, but this old guy can't jump anymore, so that's all right.
So from there, John, how do you go to how does Berkeley happen? How did that happen?
What I started studying at Illinois State University, which was quite a ways away, but and met a great educator named Ed Sof, just an amazing drummer. He played with the Woody Herman Band and Clark Terry, and he was the head drum teacher at North Texas State University. So I was just going to stay on the I-35 and drive down there and then go back to Iowa. And he goes, no, you should go to Berkeley. You should go to Boston. Right. And because there's going to be a lot more variety for you. And so, okay. So I talked my dad into shelling out some dough and moved to Boston in 1973. And I never moved back.
Wow. Did you enjoy the experience? I mean, I know you did, but I'm asking on behalf of, was it a cool experience, all the Berkeley, Boston those years?
Those years, it was fantastic. It was like, there was no digital. It was all analog. You know, we were all playing on Fender Rhodes pianos. I became the studio drummer there were no recording studios at Berkeley, and there was one. And so I learned about the click track, and I started replacing music, like music minus one stuff with, Thad Jones, Mel Lewis charts and things like that. So, and I ended up leaving my little drum set in the studio all the time. So, I became the studio drummer. That was my second semester on.
Man, John, so that was your destiny from the beginning.
yeah, man, we call it to be a studio sausage. Yeah.
John, okay, you're doing Berkeley. You're doing great. You graduate. You go to LA right away?
No, I stayed in Boston for 5 years, five and a half years. And because Boston was smoking, man. There was so many great clubs to play in, and different kinds of clubs, and jazz clubs and rock clubs and show band clubs and things like that. So I stayed there. But then I started getting antsy around 1977. And I go, I'm going to move to New York. I'm moving to New York. Everybody's moving to New York. I mean, like there was a Exodus. Everybody was going to move to New York. And then I realized that there's not that much work in New York. And so I was out on the road with a band. My last band was called Shelter. And we were touring Ohio. And that's when Rufus and Shaka came in and then kind of snagged me up. And then I moved from Boston to L.A.
Wow. It's like a movie, John.
Well, okay. Let's keep it rolling.
John, all right. So you're in L.A. You're doing, I mean, of course, Shaka Khan for a while. The studio thing came right away, or did it happen?
It did not come right away. I mean, I was in the studio with the band,
right?
And I had a lot of experience in Boston, even though I was still really learning a lot. It was a huge learning curve, you know. By the way, you just went away.
Yeah, there you go.
Gotcha. But you know, I was very frustrated, and it was 1978 when I moved there, because I really wanted to hook up with other cats. In addition to the band, and I know that's a bit selfish, but that's kind of, you know, it's what drummers do. And nobody was calling. You know, nobody knew above me, but there was a club there called Josefina's. It was in the low end of the valley. And Bobby Watson, the bass player, took me over there, and he goes, man, you gotta come here, and we're going to sit in. Because I was like the new blood, and... So we sit in, and all of a sudden there's like a line of horn players around the block waiting to sit in with us. And I go, you know, I knew some, there was some good shit going on there. So that became like a, you know, all of a sudden I see Harvey Mason sitting out there. I see Jeff Beccaro, and I see all these drummers, man. And you know, Carlos Vega, God bless him. And I became friendly with all these guys. And, you know, Danny Serafin was a good friend of mine, so he'd come hang and support. And but that 11 months, I did not work for anybody else but Rufus. So guess what I did?
What?
I had to do something. So I went down and hustled basketball at Balboa Park.
Oh, that I haven't heard before.
Yeah, I mean, I was very good in those days. And I could slam, you know, the white guys can slam. And, you know, I made the All-Star team when I was a kid at Iowa State in the summers. But I found this kid who was a guard, and I was a forward, and he was crazy, man. His name was Tommy Cedros.
Okay.
And we looked at each other. We go, you know, why don't we take those guys on over there for some money? And sure enough, so we started hustling. And I'd get to fill up the car a little bit, you know.
That's amazing, John. Okay. By the way, how tall are you? Like 6'4"?
Well, I was 6'4". I think I'm shrinking.
John, all right. Wow, that's okay, man. Pretty cool. Okay, so after that, you're still playing. And when all the studio thing came then?
Yeah, then my first session outside of Rufus was a great bass player named Joe Chimay. And he lives in Nashville. And Joe was also a great singer and sang on with Pink Floyd. And he had a solo deal. And somebody told him to call me. And he called me. And that was the first session I did outside of Rufus was Joe Chimay. And hi, Joe. And he moved to Nashville. But we did, golly, hundreds of records together later in life. And so that was really nice. And then, you know, that kind of started spreading a little bit. And I met Stephen Stills, which was very interesting. And you know, it wasn't really, I loved him, but he was not inspirational in those times.
Okay. John,
I'm
sorry to interrupt. And then how long did it took for when you first met Quincy Jones?
I met Quincy Jones just shortly after I moved to L.A. in 78.
Okay.
Our management, Mark Hartley and Larry Fitzgerald, introduced me to Quincy because they had known Quincy's a Berkeley guy and I was a Berkeley guy. So there was this concert in Los Angeles, this like get together. I forgot what it was called, but they asked me if I'd like to go there. And sure enough, and I'm sitting right by Quincy. So it was kind of a nice, you know, setup meeting. And little did I know, just a few months later, he would be producing Rufus.
Okay. And after he produces Rufus, he asked you to do session right away, or it took some time after
that
session?
It took absolutely no time. It was like he was doing the Rufus Shocker record, which was called Master Jam.
Right.
And Quincy Jones produced that. And then that literally morphed right into Off the Wall.
Wow.
So I got to you know, leave the drums at the studio. I didn't have to tear down, which was really kind of cool.
Amazing, John. They're asking many questions here. I'm going to try to go to them a little bit later. I want to keep talking to you a little bit more. Man, people are going crazy. This is... You're exploding Instagram.
I don't get to see all the stuff you're seeing. I saw some hearts.
They love you, John.
I love them too.
John, okay, what's your first session with Quincy Jones?
Well, it had to have been one of the Rufus tunes.
Outside Rufus. Outside.
Oh, it was... Thank you. I just had a total brain fart. I got asked with Ed Eckstein. Ed Eckstein used to work for Quincy, and it's Billy Eckstein's son. Great guy, still a lifelong friend. Do I do sessions outside of Rufus? And, you know, some guys would say, you know, they're not comfortable doing sessions out of their band. And I go, yeah, of course. So Ed asked me to come in. It was a Thursday. I think it was a Thursday night. And I can't remember what studio it was. And I brought my drum set in, and we had not done a Carthage session. And my roadie's name is Bear, Robert Lemons. And he's, God bless him, he's still kicking. All right. And he was a famous roadie with McCartney and Black Oak Arkansas and Three Dog Night. And Bear and I look at each other and we go, we got to haul my shit from here to there. And so he had like a 62 Ford telephone truck with an open back bed. We just threw all the drums in there. And, you know, and back then they were all my drums that I paid for, you know, right. So I got like, be careful, you know, and we go down and set up, and I set up, and it was Quincy Jones and, Bruce Swedeen, the engineer. And I don't know who else is in the room. Okay. And, the first song was, Girlfriend, written by Paul McCartney. For Off the Wall. Right. And I'm like, you know, I wrote a chart out and got the click, got my mix right, and nailed it. And I could see this guy's behind the glass talking. And then they talk back and they go, hey, you want to do another song? I go, yeah. So they put, and it's a Carol Bayer Sager, David Foster song called It's the Falling in Love. And it was kind of very poppy, kind of 16th note oriented. And I nailed that. And I'm sitting there, I'm done after, you know, an hour or so, hour and a half of the two tunes. And I see them talking and they push the talk back down and they go, what are you doing Monday? And I go, I'm not doing anything. Well, you want to come back and do the rest of the record? And I go, yes. So that weekend, nevertheless, was one fucking great party.
Let's just put it this way.
Wow. And, I'll tell you what we did when I came in on Monday. It was the first time I had met Greg Fillinganes. And Greg Fillinganes is, you know, the greatest piano player next to Herbie Hancock ever. And that song, when we walked in and got to know each other, the song was Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. And we cut that and looked at each other. It was just, I don't remember anybody else but me and Greg playing it. I don't remember a bass player. I think Greg had a mini Moog with a Rhodes. And I don't remember guitar players, and I know there were guitar players. I don't remember any of them. And I know who were on the record, which was, Wawa and David Williams and things like that. But after we had cut that song, literally that first take, I looked over at Greg and he looked at me, and we knew that we had a number one record.
Right.
It was just that feeling that just came over. We just knew there was something special about what went down.
Wow. That's amazing, John. And by the way, you mentioned David Foster was, at that moment, he was just the songwriter. He wasn't producing yet at that time.
He, He was producing also, but I had not worked for him, but he was mostly a session player songwriter that turned into a producer. And I mean, you know, dude, he was playing on so many things in the 70s and just naturally, you know, turned into a songwriter. And that was the, ironically, you know, because I'm his drummer.
I know.
Now.
We know.
Well, but ironically, that was one of the first songs I played was his song.
Wow.
So that, it was kind of a small world. But no, I first met David. I met David in 1981. We were doing a Bill Champlin record called Runaway. And it was a great record, man. Bill Champlin was so great. And then David... He was a session player on like Just Once, you know, Quincy Jones, James Ingram, and we started like really hitting it off. So,
wow, John, I'm from there. It's just madness. Just in the studio every day.
When people I'm in the studio have... now, that didn't
John, John, I mean, all this boom is going on. You're recording all these albums. I'm sure there were people asking you to go on tour. Were you always like, no, thank you? Or were you thinking about it about that time? Well, how was that?
Well, you know, I was loyal to the band Rufus. You know, when I first joined Rufus, I had first of all targeted the band in Boston. I knew everything about the band. I liked the fact they were a mixed band, you know, mixed race. They did rock and roll. They did blues. And they did R&B and jazz. And who was in love with Chaka Khan? So it was just all these things that led up to that. But when I first joined Rufus, Chaka told me, I'm leaving the band. And I go, oh, shit, I just got in the band. And he goes, well, why don't you come with me? And I go, well, I can't. You know, I'm loyal to the guys. But nevertheless, as time went on and then we got back together, you know, the history speaks for itself, you know, with Ain't Nobody and the Grammys. But I started working for other people. I started working with Lionel Richie and Lionel, you know, I did a song for him in 1981 called You Are. And then we went into all this other stuff with All Night Long and stuff later. But Lionel asked me to go on the road. And I go, I don't want to go on the road. I mean, I was happy kind of doing this and doing all these dates and that sort of thing. And then, I mean, I can tell you probably in a list, a couple of hands here who asked me to go on the road. I was asked to join Foreigner twice.
Wow.
Twice. And I go, man. And the second time was a friggin' insult. It was like, yeah, man, we're going to pay you double scale and you can go on the road with us. I go, bye. And that's, you know, it's the great Steve Winwood, who's I idolize. Kind of came out of the doldrums and wrote this amazing record with Higher Love and Back in the High Life. And he asked me to go on the road and he didn't have a lot of money to pay. But the year later, he had a shitload of money. I didn't go out with him. Michael Jackson, he and I talked about me going out and it was determined that possibly, it was not right. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
I'm going to be cool about that. I joined Stanley Clarke and George Duke and did those first two records. Did not tour. We did a couple of dates, but strictly studio, even though we played Saturday Night Live together in 1980. Let's see, who else did I turn down? Bob Seger.
John, this is crazy. Here, or Motor are trying to add people of we want a tour, and you're adding people that you denied.
Yeah, but you know, everybody thinks that, you know, it's just a golden shower of rainbow shit all over you, but it's like there's other stuff going on too, you know. There's like, you know, you join Bob Seger, then I got to move to Detroit. I don't want to move to Detroit, you know, and you know what? And then people like yelled at me when I became musical director for John Fogerty, because I used to love Creedence. And I go, I get some of these like jazz and funk guys going, why would you join John Fogerty? Ooh, three chords. Ick. And I go, you know what, man? The guy's an American icon. And I became musical director. Unfortunately, it was during when he couldn't play any Creedence tunes. He was being sued. So that was an ugly, ugly point in time. So, anyway, I'm rambling. Give me some more.
John, wow.
Yes.
For all my Spanish audience, speaking audience, that they're crazy here asking questions. They're asking me about Luis Miguel. Let's talk about Luis Miguel for... I mean, by the way, I love all those records with Luis Miguel's, you know what I mean?
I think I did six. I think probably. I did six records. You know, and it's interesting. Quincy Jones called Luis Miguel one of the greatest voices he had ever heard. And, you know, and that's, you know, Quincy, we were all connected with Warner Brothers at that time. And when I can't remember when I first started working with Luis, but he was such a nice guy. He was fun. He sang, and he still does. His pitch was just phenomenal. His breath support and, you know, his melodic content and his rhythmical phrasing. It's like what we look at it as drummers when we're playing with singers. So I was very blessed to, you know, be part of that that great career that he's had.
Right. John, I mean, just for them, because they're crazy asking questions here. Who, could you mention more Spanish singers that you have worked with?
Oh, my God. Oh, singers. Well, Maria Conchita. I know we're live, and you know what? I'm divorced twice. It doesn't matter.
John, at this time, you could say anything you want, man.
I can. But I was going to go to Venezuela. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
All right. Oh, golly. There's hundreds. You know, and I got to work with the great producer Juan Carlos Calderon.
Right.
Unfortunately passed away.
Feliciano?
Jose. Yeah, Christian Castro.
Right.
No, I was always like Christian's mom, Veronica. Hi, Veronica. let's see here. Los Temenarios.
Los Temenarios.
We did a bunch of stuff with them. I got to work with a lot of guys out of Miami. All right. Lots of times they would bring us, when there were budgets, they'd fly us out of L.A. and put us up in Miami, and we'd record there. And we did a whole bunch of records with Rudy Perez producing.
Rudy Perez, right. Well, I'm reading all the comments here, and they're sending love from Uruguay, Argentina, Mexico, Peru. Oh, they're asking me here... let's go to the drum geek gear, the stuff, a little bit. Which drum set did you use for the record with Michael Jackson, Thriller?
Well, it was Thriller, but it was, let's go off the wall. And it would have been a Gretsch. I actually used a Gretsch drum set I bought in Boston in 75. Okay. With a 22, 12, 13, and a 16. And then later I bought a 24-inch bass drum and an 18-inch floor tom that matched that. But that, I got a Yamaha endorsement in 1981. So I started then that transition of coming out of that old Gretsch sound into really, really good Yamaha recording customs.
Right. Another one. I know it's kind of like a crazy tough question, but I want to please everybody. They're asking, what's the favorite song you have recorded?
Oh my gosh.
I know. Or you have maybe something special that has always been in your mind.
It's not going to be a Julio Iglesias song. I know. But everybody, let's do, what was it, 1000 Bel Air Place. Let's download that. So I love Julio.
We'll do.
Oh my God, I have stories, but we are not going to talk about that. My favorite song, I think I have to make that three.
Okay.
You know, Rock With You is extremely close to me because, first of all, Rod Temperton wrote it, And Rod was just one of the great writers we had with that group, with the Quincy Jones group. And he came out of, Heat Wave. And also the nice thing about Rock With You was it was my band. It was the band with, it was Rufus. It was Bobby Watson on bass and Hawk Walensky on keyboards. And then we used David Williams on guitar. And that was something special, you know. It was just, it was different. It was different than all those other Michael Jackson tunes. And to me, it holds up. Another song would be probably Higher Love by Steve Winwood, which I got to kind of mess around with a little bit and, you know, show this, my Southwest Iowa, timbale chops on a snare drum, you know, later, with it. And then maybe Ain't Nobody. It has to be very special to me because that beat is so damn hard to play still to this day. But it worked, and, it led to the Grammy. So,
John.
Yeah.
Now that you talk about that beat, did they write it out? Did you just came? Can you explain about that?
Yeah, this was, first of all, Hawk Walensky, the writer, it was our principal keyboard player with Rufus, and he had written the song, and he wrote everything, and he wrote the lyrics and everything. It was all self-contained. Not many people can do that. You know, most people have to reach out and get some sort of help, the lyrics or something. So he had a demo, and he demoed it at his house, and he used a Linn drum machine, and he goes, okay, this is Rufus time. We're going to go in. John, you're going in and you're going to redo the drums. I go, great. But he kept his mini move, whatever the hell, Jupiter 8 synth line or bass line. He kept that. He didn't want Bobby playing on it. So I go, shit, okay. So I listened to what he played and it was so robotic that I go, okay, I've got to nail most of this, but play it like me. So we went into Amigo Studios, owned by Warner Brothers, and I taped a bunch of, towel on my right leg, so I could actually keep the motion going. And I cut the song with just kick drum and snare drum. And then I went over after I got that done for the 5 minutes, which just wore me out. It was hard to do and be that precise.
Right.
And then I overdubbed the broken up hi-hat. And then I overdubbed the tom fills. And then I overdubbed the cymbal crashes.
Okay.
And that's how it came. And I used a custom Yamaha 9-inch snare drum for that song. Made it really fat and dead. And if you listen to that song, I mean, wherever you are, it still holds up. And that was 1982.
I know. This is huge. I mean, this is a heavy podcast for me to find, John. I'm having a blast. John, going back to David Foster, I know you still tour with him right now these days.
Except for, our problem. Yeah, we start back up in October.
Okay. Is there a difference between working with him in the studio against live, or is it the same vibe, the same thing?
The studio, he's more intense, he's a perfectionist. He's a perfectionist. I've done a lot of work with him in the studio, like with, Whitney Houston and Peter Cetera and all sorts of different things. Chicago, literally, I'm on Chicago 17. I'm a ghost drummer. And he, he's extremely precise. And he'll look at you and go, you call that a backbeat? Yeah, I just totally fuck with you, man. and I'll say, well, can I get your left hand a little sooner in my cans?
That's a good one.
we have this 40-year relationship, which is good. But, and now he's married to Catherine, and, she's done really good with him. And he's just really smooth, enjoys touring. He's playing his ass off. writing his ass off. He's been writing new stuff, and either for Broadway or like solo piano stuff. And I just am very blessed to be able to tour with him.
Nice. So you still join touring? I mean, you just mean your life, but you do enjoy
every night. Right. Yeah, and then, you know, look for us. I mean, we're only touring the States this year, and January we're going to be, I think there's like 33 days we're out straight.
Wow. Amazing. Well, John, you have a solo album, which is Smoking.
I had two. One I did years and years ago called Feng Shui, and then my second one was called Platinum.
Right.
And I'm working on a third one right now, which is really aggressive and avant-garde.
Could you talk a little bit about that one or not yet?
To fund a record is really expensive, and so that's why you see people releasing just one song at a time now. So I'm not sure how that's going to go. A lot of the stuff I've written, there's some of it is still not completed, but you know, things working with my brain. As like, you know, I'll be looking outside and then I'll come up with an idea, but that idea may be stored away for 2 weeks. And then I'll go, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that. And like, you know, just this week, I wrote a song called Liquid Office. And because, you know, I have a jacuzzi and I get in my jacuzzi and all of a sudden I have all this office, my brain starts working really cool. So, and I'm playing all the parts. I'm playing every single part on this. And I think people will be surprised. It's kind of ethereal. 12-8-4-4, a little weather reportish means something. So that's okay. One thing. But I've got these other tunes that are so nasty and rock funk that you know, we're slowly letting these things. You know, not all songs come quick. So let's just put it that way. So. Right. And then I have a writing partner. Her name is Maya Ajuzina, and she lives in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And we have been we've had some success together, and now we're working on a new song that I've redone and everything, and sent it back to her, and she's working on the vocals now, and it's kind of that's a long distance away, but it's working.
Wow, amazing, John. And could you talk a little bit of the person who's going to be playing at the record, or you don't want to talk about that yet?
Well, geez, I had everybody on my second record. I mean, as of now, it's just me. And, you know, I know that's kind of an arrogant Prince attitude, but because I play guitar and bass too. So, but, you know what? Once I dial into what I think the direction of the record's going to be, then I'll go and you know, call up Neil or Nathan or Abraham or Stanley.
Those guys.
Yeah, them or John Pena.
John, and obviously I know, but you still if anybody want to work with you and send you tracks. You're able to do that, right? You're approachable to do that too, right?
I am totally approachable. I mean, obviously, if you know, it's got to be a song that's a song, you know. Right. But no, I mean, you know, a lot of people think I'm not approachable, but in reality, I mean, look, you know, I've got a beautiful studio here, and this is my control room, and then I took over my house. Here, I'll show you. Because I can. What I did was. I just took over my house, and my drum room is this huge living room.
Oh, wow.
With 25-foot ceilings. So, and I'm fully mic'd, and I can tell you this, it sounds better here than Capitol. So
I could imagine, yeah, of course.
If people want to hire me for something, and I am into producing projects also, they can go to my website, which is www.johnjrobinson.com. And there's like tabs there, and they can get a hold of me that way.
Oh, beautiful. Great. Talking about JR, you know that for a bit, I was confused about I thought it was John Robinson Jr., but then I learned it's JR. I mean, if you want to tell the story, I mean, it's not that, but please.
Well, years and years and years ago, Quincy Jones had nicknames for everybody. So this is during off the wall days. And so like Hawks was Hawk. Michael Jackson's was Smelly. Lewis Johnson's was Boot. George Johnson was Hen. Michael Boddicker was Lily. Jerry Hayes was, God dog it, what was Jerry's? I can't remember. And mine was JR. So I got my initials, thank God.
You were lucky.
I could have had some sort of really doofus friggin' nickname. But then that ended up getting shortened from John J.R. Robinson. It was John Robinson, because that was my dad's name. And then Umberto Gatica starts calling me J.R., get J.R. Robinson, you know, with his Chilean accent. Get J.R. Robinson. And then that pretty soon that stuck. And then my dad, when he was alive, he goes, what's this J.R. shit? You know, I go, hey, trust me, let's just roll with it. It's all good.
Well, John, this has been an amazing, incredible podcast for us. People here are going crazy saying how much they love you, your work. Oh. From all over the world, John. I mean, especially Latin America, Canada as well. And Instagram will cut us in like in an hour, and we're almost there. But let me see if I can answer a few questions so they don't
get Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Well, they say you could write a book. Yeah, we know that. Have you thought about that, writing a book?
I have thought about it extensively, and I've got a lot of information. And, you know, we have these non-disclosure things we've signed. You know what, man? That shit's going in the book. I don't care. So, you know, the thing about a book is, you know, A, do I have a little gopher guy follow me around with a little digital recorder when I remember an idea or remember the story? You know, like, for example, here's a story. We're playing the Rose Bowl with Quincy Jones Band, and Michael Jackson is our guest star. So this is years ago, and it's almost showtime, and I'm like backstage, and Quincy's already on stage looking at his music. He's looking at me, goes, JR, get your ass up here. And I go, okay, and I'm coming. Just so you guys know, during this concert, Michael was crazy. He's like climbing up the damn scaffolding and shit. He was having a good time. But right before the show, Quincy's yelling at me, and he's going, get up here. And the bouncer, this big dude, won't let me on stage. I had long blonde hair and shit. And he goes, man, you're not the drummer, man. And I go, I'm the drummer. I got to go. Look, Quincy's yelling at me. Look. He goes, no, he isn't. And all of a sudden, I go, and then Quincy goes, let him in, man. So I go, see? So, I go back to the bouncer, and I go, you know, so you, sorry. So there's an old story.
John, unfortunately, we have to go, but this has been amazing. I mean, thank you for the inspiration. Thank you for your legacy. Thank you for all the things you have done for music and drums. And thank you for being so humble and so cool. I mean, because that's very important, too, and you're both things. So thank you very much. And I always close down with, if you could get an advice to the younger generation, to the young kids, they want to get into music. And, you know, just an advice for the young people. Young
musicians. Well, first of all, best to you. You're a great guy and fellow Paiste artist. So, yeah, baby. for all the young drummers and even the older ones, because I've started, like, occasionally teaching some older guys again that quit. But they originally had that passion. And why did they have that passion? You know, so it's important for the young guys to lasso that passion they've got and turn that into something productive and positive, because we're all this family, but we're all different, you know, and drummers are special. You know, we're the band leaders. We're the glue. So, you know, I just say, you know, don't ever give up on your dreams, you guys and gals, and and just try to do something new and change the world somehow. Make it fun. And if you ever lose the fact that it's fun, then move on to another gig.
Wise words, amazing words, John. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you soon.
All right, buddy. Love everybody. No more. Love you, buddy.
Thanks. You, John.
Chao.
Productora, musiquita.
Wow. What an amazing night, guys. What an amazing guy. What a maestro, musician. Thank you, John. Mr. John Robinson. Gracias a todos los que están por aquí. De verdad que fue un placer estar con ustedes. Qué podcast, ya tú sabes. Y estamos gozando. Tertulias con Omar Negroni. Thank you, Mr. John Robinson. What an amazing an hour we have of a lot of knowledge. A lot of knowledge for all of us. So we're going to have the great saxophone player, Miguel Zenón. See you guys. Tertulias con Omar Negroni. Dale.